Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many such centers located throughout the world, and in addition, there are study groups here, there, and everywhere. And each of these centers of study, each of these collections or associations of independent thinkers are independent, they're autonomous, they're locally sustained by voluntary efforts of time, service, and certainly money. And the one binding feature of all activities, if you were to travel this summer around the world and visit a variety of lodges, you would find at the United Lodge of Theosophists one short, sweet declaration, and that is the one common anchor, if you will. It's both the anchor and the wind beneath our wings for all activities at all study centers and lodges. I'd like to read that to you this morning. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So there's the guiding declaration of purpose upon which the volunteers here in Philadelphia base their efforts. We're finishing up with the so-called winter periodical in the next week or so, and then the summer we'll have a new periodical coming out for July, August, and September. This month of June, we've been looking on Sundays at practical theosophy. So each Sunday at 10:30, the building opens. There's time for purchase of books or pamphlets for home use at the book table, or there's time at the book table if someone wants to volunteer in some way. Then promptly from 11 to 12 on Sunday mornings, we've been having presentations on the theme of practical theosophy. This morning is the last such presentation. My partner and I will be dealing with thorough altruism and self-sacrifice. Next Sunday, June 25th, is a special celebration or commemorative day. It is ULT Day, and the topic of that particular morning will be the United Lodge of Theosophists, its mission, and future. We ask everyone that's involved in the presentation, introduction, or the talk, or the readings to be in place in the front of the room 10 minutes or so early so that there's a meditative tone that can be set for this day. It is also an official observation of the passing of Robert Crosby. Wednesday nights, the building opens at 5:15. And until 7:15, there's a reference library available in the front of this floor. There's always a volunteer available to assist with any individual line of study, and it's a straight theosophical collection, but it is a reference library, not a lending library. The study class on Wednesday nights is finishing up from 7:30 to 8:30 this coming Wednesday, the 21st. There's a presentation of The Key to Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky. On the little table near the usher's chair, you can find a selection for this coming Wednesday's discussion. During the summer months, the presentations will change. Wednesday nights will be devoted to a common study of the Bhagavad Gita, and Sunday mornings during July and September only, there will be presentations on the aphorisms of karma, and those little pamphlets will become available in a little bit, in a couple of weeks. So that's what we're about in Philadelphia. If you're traveling, you will find similar but certainly autonomous activities elsewhere. Now this morning, along the lines of practical theosophy, we're dealing with thorough altruism and self-sacrifice. And in preparing for this morning, considering the words thorough and altruism, it struck as a thought that the word thorough usually has to do with active critical thinking, with rigorous attention to detail, if you will, complete with regard with every detail. And that sounds like brain function. That sounds like the eye doctor. Altruism, on the other hand, the keynote behind this philosophy is the belief or practice of disinterested, or we would say detached, or selfless concern and devotion for the cause of others. And that sounds very much like the heart doctrine, involving intuition and direct cognition. And so we have within those two terms a synthesis of what right living can be about, what our goal should be for living. And looking through dictionaries and whatnot, what was very curious to this student was that after the definition of altruism was given, the prime example always was parenting in the animal kingdom, selfless devotion and care of another. But the example given was always in nature, in the animal kingdom. So why end the month's study of practical theosophy with looking at altruism? Well, in the modern theosophical movement, if you consider the three fundamental propositions and try to use them in daily life, aren't they all about the rationale, the root of altruism as a lifestyle, as a practical application of the philosophy? The premise of universal brotherhood being rooted in the spirit of each and all, of desire, compassionate law, what we call karma, arising within the absolute and therefore governing all of manifestation in every angle, above us, below us, side to side, every aspect of living. If we think of absolute abstract justice, where there's no tricking law and order, there's no flavor of the month getting somebody off the hook, there's no indulgent parent overlooking the effects, but rather absolute abstract justice for every cause, there's an equal and opposite effect. And the invitation in the self-conscious entity to look over that, learn from that, and do better with each application. Isn't that the most comprehensive statement of altruism of all? No effort wasted, no punishment entailed, but rather an opportunity that is ongoing and universal. And that third fundamental proposition, sometimes called the pivotal doctrine, that once soul has arrived to working through the human kingdom, it is at this point that self-fulfilled and self-devised methods impact not only the path of a particular soul, but impacts all of manifestation and all soul as it is refracted or reflected throughout all forms of manifestation. And in that statement of evolution and our role as free and independent thinkers, we find the greatest rationale for altruistic thinking of all. There are so many different quotes that we could use from different books, and you could do a study in the Key to Theosophy and an article on charity and be informed about charity of mind and the production of charity or altruistic practicality on more than the physical plane. You could look into Christian scriptures with the Sermon on the Mount. Certainly the Buddhist precepts frequently reflected the voice of the silence are great. And we'll have plenty of time to discuss all of that after my partner discusses the application of self-sacrifice.
We didn't know that we were going to talk about the application of self-sacrifice.
Oh,
however, it is applicable because if it is not applied, it is nothing. So what is self-sacrifice? Well, first of all, what is the self? Well, we know that, or some do not know, but we assume that everyone here knows that there are two selves, because I'm sure there's a conversation going on in everyone's mind, daily or sometimes all day long. And then there's that moment of clarity when you are just looking upon an idea and are not swayed by one's personality. But the personal self is what we use to maneuver in this ocean that we are immersed in. It's these bodies, these intelligent lives, this personal being. This is so intimately tied with all of nature, and this body. We are one with nature. So that personal self uses that to enable itself to come in contact with the material world and to influence it, to stimulate it, to move it forward. And this is done through sacrifice. Sacrifice is a formula for how the universe works. Sacrifice. There's a couple of quotes I think that will help. We think that will. Through the law of sacrifice, man succeeds in paying his own karmic debts. When action is performed as sacrifice, its reaction is altruistic. Now, we wanted to understand sacrifice because we know it as what? Denial. But it's more than that. It's a deep feeling of respect that as a child's first feeling is for its mother, so the first spiritual aspiration of the awakening inner nature is from the man of fire, who embodies and expresses that devotion through his sacrifice. At his flame, we kindle our little lamp, and protecting it against the winds of impurity, the fogs of superstition, the mist of sense attraction, the biting snows of selfishness, we march forward to the Holy of Holies. We just have to read these. There's a word in Sanskrit for sacrifice, yajna. It's we think of self-sacrifice narrowly as personally, but in the grander scope, it's an attitude of mind, and it's a humbleness of nature that we consider ourselves an intricate part of that oneness, that how we act does have an effect on all of life that we touch, both mentally, astrally, and physically. We touch each other. And that the reason that sacrifice exists, this is the explanation that's given in the Secret Doctrine. Nature is one. Beings in nature act and react on each other. Thus, circles and cycles are formed. The larger circle narrowing itself to meet and mingle with the smaller, and the latter expanding and becoming one with the former, producing the phenomenon sacrifice. And of course, our myth of sacrifice is of the sacrificing the body. Now, in such an age as this, the ritualistic sacrifice of a different age, which was indeed a magical effect, becomes a sacrifice to be performed by each man in his own nature and upon the altar of his own heart. William Q. Judge. So, this is a battle that goes on forever and ever. And we see in all the kingdoms how they sacrifice themselves for the next higher kingdom. There is no choice. This is how nature works. It moves on, progresses, always aspiring to a higher state of consciousness. Our duty is to act in harmony with that law. That's what we have to do. But because of the lower personality and it becoming so out of control, because it was given that control by us, that we searched and we made it smart, we made it clever, we made it strong. We did this. It's all about me. And this is how we've been raised. And this is what we've been exposed to. That does not mean that's how we are. We just know that this is the personal nature. And the personal nature has weaknesses. Our duty is to find that which is not or unchanging, that which is constant, eternal, immutable, omnipresent. That conception in our mind that makes note of every day, the changes that it sees. So, this self is personal. The higher self is always impersonal, because it isn't the same in all of us. But the only way it can be accessed is impersonally. We can't get our head through the needle, because our lower nature has gotten out of control. And it thinks it's the end-all, be-all, and know-all. But that's only half. That's only half. And that is, the truth path is one of inner devotion, one of self-sacrifice. But it's not something that someone may say, well, look at this person. He's so humble and sacrificing. No. It's in your nature. And you do it with joy and with happiness, because you know you're helping. You're moving things forward. That's where the joy and the strength comes from. Well, we'll stop there, because we keep on hearing the same voice, and I think we need a change.
So in regards to self-sacrifice, then, it's the higher self that is coming down to manifestation or something that is sacrificing itself to hold up the lower? Is that what we're confused a little?
You're thinking too much. No, it's just very simple. We have a lower mind, which is part of the higher mind, but it's the lower aspect of it that comes in contact with the material world. And through this contact, man is able to become, one with all of life. He has that potential, because he has within his very nature all the constituent parts of nature, all of them. But this higher nature is eternal, boundless, immutable, omnipresent, and that our duty is to make that the ever-present moment of our life. So that's like when you meditate, there's that feeling, that moment of clarity. It's there, but you need to bring it into this realm, in some shape or form. You know, it's the expression of your inner self. You know, you have clear moments and you see harmony, and that's an idea. Turn it into a word, and you turn it into a deed.
The philosophy presents the proposition, as was stated, that there is the absolute, and that radiant within and from that, I don't know the correct prepositions that would work, comes spirit and soul masked by manifestation. So as soul, we are radiant in that possibility, in that potentiality, because in fact, that's the reality from which we come. But as was said, across incarnations, we've used mind and lost ourselves in the desires of matter, and therefore forgotten perhaps that we are soul working through manifestation. The voice says, raise the self by the self. So what's being raised is the use of the lower mind, the attitudes of that lower mind, and that's to be elevated through sacrifice and intentional devotion. That's to be elevated, purified, so that very naturally what will happen is that recollection of the moment of spirit will become a living power in life.
who is doing the sacrificing?
So if we are soul as perceivers, all sacrifice starts in the mind. The reality is in the mind. The sacrifice of doing the better instead of the dearer. The sacrifice of trying to keep focused on what's the most harmonious reaction in this moment. This, what's going on is all of the personal energies, all of the personal desires, the use of the brain is being turned, transmuted, uplifted. But in that process, what's dropping away? The dross. Is that the sacrifice? Or is the sacrifice the effort of the spirit to actually function on the plane? Crosby in The Eternal Verity says, the whole universe is action. First, last, and all the time, ceaseless motion. Thought being the real plane of action and that which induces any kind of action. Within the spiritual nature lie every possible force, power, and means for the creation of a more and more perfect instrument and the ability to cease to deal in every case with causes rather than effects.
It sounds like you're talking about self-surrender, like letting go of our ego, like with the little e. There's another spelling with the big E, that means a group soul. But letting go of that ego and being in the here and now, not, you know, dwelling in the past or running away to the future, just letting go of everything and being here.
That's right. Well, that's exactly what we're talking about. That's what the Gita talks about and the Voice of the Silence, is that resignation. And but resignation is only can be discovered through devotion.
And resignation is an interesting concept, because resignation can be the most selfish, self-centered mental activity of all times. If the letting go and being in the now means that the motive, the attitude of mind is to develop the best karma for the next incarnation, to reach personal nirvana, to have the application of what me worry, the rest of you people take care of you, I'm about me. All of those things are a perversion of the meaning of resignation and detachment or meditative being in the moment. The great effort is to try to figure out meditatively the kindest, most sincere, purest, altruistic thinking and action to be done that will harm nothing, that will work to empower all others to help themselves, and then to resign from that. Just, you know, I've mindfully thought this out. This is what I'm going to try to do to serve, as Kuan Yin's pledge would have me, and now I resign from the outcome, the effect, and we'll see what happens.
And that can only be done by living in the moment, not living in the future, not living in the past, but just being present and creating the world in which you live consciously.
There's been a hand here.
Yes.
I wanted to ask a question about this. It's kind of looped in my mind a little bit. Is that I've read Sufi thought that our reality is actually a great charity on behalf of God. That God was already existing. God already had God going on. But for some reason, and that's a great mystery of existence, God decided there would be other things. And then, of course, we are one of those other things. We are, you know, God's children, or everyone view it. Do you think that we are the product of God's charity, or do you think we're a product, or is it not that simple?
Well, we have to frame the question a little differently.
Okay.
All right. Well, the idea of God. All right. Mm-hmm. We can use that term, but we just cannot limit it.
Okay. Well, they can say that.
Yeah. That this unknown source of life comes forth, and that within it is all things. Okay? We only know of what we see in this man, but there are other worlds, you know, other states of consciousness that we are not totally aware of, somewhat, but not totally aware. And that there is a source of intelligence, but it has no beginning and has no end. It is a part of that absolute. It is the higher being of that principle we call manas. It merges into buddhi, and it's, you know, clairvoyance, clear seeing. It's all of these powers that we are told will come to fruition as a natural stage of man's evolution. But man must become morally and ethically sound.
Sure. My question was, do you think we're the product of charity? Do you think we're the product of sacrifice?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We are hopefully perpetuating that.
Because that's the return. It's the return of deities by performing the same Tao that they did before the world was successful.
Well, it's, I think I read a quote about the fire.
Or is the secret doctrine put it, what is the emergence, what is it, power bomb out of all graffiti, I think that's what it says?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Well, it is correct, but we have to be very careful not to be anthropomorphic in our thinking.
Right.
And that when we say we are made or created, the theosophical term would be that we evolve, that this is a natural process. So, in other words, the same way as we see the sun rise in the morning with very cool, very neutral colors, very purely into the atmosphere, and then we see the sun set in the evening in colors that are hot and vibrant and red and yellow, having picked up the heat of the day and the illusions of the day, that natural coming and going, there's no God force behind it creating that. That is natural law of this universal action or vibration, if you will.
Okay, I thought that was the product of God force, but okay.
We're probably fighting with English.
Yeah,
language.
I don't know what to do.
Do you know?
Yeah. It was a dispute I had in my mind because the opposite suit you, the ones who are critical of that view, that this is a charity, also agree with what you said, that it's wrong to put anthropomorphic limitations to date. And so by doing that, they consider it heretical in some schools of thought, but some schools of thought go with the idea that no, we are the representation or the reflection of.
This is why in 1875, when the founders got together to bring that modern theosophical movement into the West, the invitation, the opportunity was to study comparative religions and line them up and get behind the trap of the jargon or the language in which they were written, to try to get to the concepts and the principles behind that are universal and powerfully the same. There's a hand over here.
I've heard it one time that these teachings are for sinners, not for the righteous. And as a consequence, when we listen and we hear the terminology used, it's advised that we contemplate them, we accept them, and then concentrate. This leads to the use of that life we lead. And when we see how that is put together, then we check the source. That source of those three fundamental ideas of deity, law, and evolution. So if we keep it simple at first, as I said, it's for sinners. And therefore, we have to learn the language. And we've heard often language from the soul rather than the form.
And as we share the process together, one of the strengths of the study is to have a center like this one where minds can come together, because we find as we study something and we get beyond some of the traps of language or, you know, the container of the idea, as we come around to the study again, we're in a new perspective now, because we've lived a whole year of experiences, seeing things from new angles, and therefore see the information presented in a new way as well. Follow up?
And the follow up is that we hear people say, woe is me. And our society today, being as materialistic as it is, we lose all hope of ever understanding. And we feel sad and let down. But it appears that the study of the ocean routine and coming up to Bhagavad Gita, you begin to form a basis for rational thinking. Then we'll be able to proceed step by step.
Seems like all these mystical schools have an anthropomorphic side of it and a mystical side. In other words, the Christ isn't a human being, it's an awakening, it's a conscious. The Buddha could be a male or a female, it's not somebody's name. Anybody could be a Buddha, anybody could be a Christ. And that's where they've lost, you know, the perspective.
Yes, yes.
Making it into something personal instead of impersonal.
Well, yes. That is the truth. You had a question?
So our understanding that the word sacrifice means to make holy, or to make sacred or holy, and we are advised or counseled that one of the ways to do that is through certain ascetic practices, that we should start with denying ourselves, in a sense, certain things, maybe so that others can benefit. Is that right? Or is that... I mean, we know that just being a... like, there are certain sects in India that they... you know, they nearly starve themselves to death, and that might not be such a holy thing, but we're talking about, like, more practical asceticism, like just not indulging in the senses, but by scaling back, pulling back, and developing some ascetic practices. Is that one way to go about it?
Well, if it's going to make you miserable, don't do it. If you're going to make you unhappy, don't do it. It has to be done in a heartfelt way.
And what if you're already miserable?
it could be a breaking out of that shell. It could be. Because it will gather about you great conflict. Because to sacrifice, it has to be joyous. It has to be meaningful. It has to be done through knowledge. And there's a story that's in one of the books about a mother who is forlorning that her children don't know about self-sacrifice. Here she is, she has five children, and she knows what self, she's given them everything that they needed. She's protected them, and they have everything, but they don't have any idea what self-sacrifice is. How do we teach them? How do we show them what self-sacrifice is? And the sage's answer was knowledge. Knowledge. Hmm. You have to know who you are and what we're all part of. And you have to have a realization of our oneness. You know, and it goes on and on, and our greatness and everything, but we have made this world what it is. And self-sacrifice is very, very difficult, especially in this world, because the body doesn't have a chance to shut down because it is stimulated so much by the environment in which it lives. You know, if we lived a contemplative life and we were, you know, we had a retreat or whatever, we could gather and reflect and have that way of life, it's easier to do that and then come back, and perhaps it's stronger now. But, you know, that's the battle we fight, all of us.
Well, as his partner, I'm going to fight the battle with the comment just made. If we premise that we are to bloom where we're planted, we wake up in the morning, our head comes off the pillow, and we are in the conditions that we need. We don't have to go to an ashram or an oceanside resort or wherever. We're right where we need to be to sow kindly acts. So if we do very small incremental changes in our thinking, if we begin the day with gratitude, I woke up. I still can stand up and walk. You know, I still have this safe place to be upon arising. If we begin with that kind of thinking and we then continue practically through the day, doing the duties that come before us, maybe we're in charge of a whole household, maybe we're in charge of companion animals, maybe we have a business that we've got to pursue, or perhaps we just are in a solitary existence and our duties take us to a food market, or maybe they take us to the public library. Carrying that so kindly acts thought with you and being the kindest and most considerate you can be is a beginning. And even in a media-driven world, in the astral kind of energy that my partner just referred to a little bit ago, even in that, don't we have free will and choice about what we focus on, what idea we're going to hold and give power to? We don't have to turn on the radio. We don't have to turn on the TV. Nobody tells us we have to read all those newspapers. Instead, if we can just continually turn our thinking lower mind to what's the kindly deed in this moment at this time, and if that is consistently done, we're in the practice of taking abstract, absolute altruism into a very practical application. And that is self-sacrifice. It's very simple at the heart of it.
Wait, is this a debate?
Sure, let's go for it.
Recreate, recreation, a change of environment, going to Maine for a month,
now
doing something where you can see contrast. That's all. Contrast. And a place where it is quiet. That's just recreating or just becoming in touch with who you really are.
And
debate over.
Okay. The point is, each thought generated by soul working through the matter, the substance of the brain and the lower mind, is recreating moment by moment. And you can be in a physical paradise and be in the greatest of internal turmoil. We each know that. We create that for ourselves. Yeah.
The second talk on sacrifice. Can the second
you shouldn't
quote,
point.
The second quote be read again? It was kind of a combination of sacrifice and altruism. Could that just be read again, please? We think it was the second one.
Do you remember which reading
which
you referred
about?
To?
A child's first feeling of love for its mother.
First
spiritual aspiration of the awakening inner.
That's okay. It was just a nice segue of self-sacrifice into altruism. So never mind. That's fine. If it can't be found.
Well, we read that in such an age as this, the ritualistic sacrifice of a different age, which was indeed a magical effect, becomes a sacrifice to be formed by each man in his own nature upon the altar of his own heart.
Is that what you were thinking about?
No, that's fine.
Okay. I guess the presentation this morning is altruism as an ideal and a principle, eternal concept, and that it is reflected or manifested in the process of individualized self-sacrifice.
When action is performed as sacrifice, it is its reaction is altruistic.
There it is. Perfect. And what was your source for that, in case they want to look at it?
That was in the Secret Doctrine.
Yes. Secret Doctrine.
So if we're looking to move in the direction of a greater understanding and application of altruism, and sacrificing is one of the means of accomplishing this, or making ourselves more aware of certain things, then it's obviously done, in inner ways, on the inner plane. There are certain things that we sacrifice in the closet of our own heart.
Correct.
And karma yoga comes to mind. Can we take a look at what the doctrine of karma yoga is and see if that applies to this?
Well, it certainly does. It's we are all compelled to act. And the understanding of karma yoga is that we act not looking for the results of our action. Doing that and giving it up to the highest that we understand, to the universal. And that in the performance of action, we are single-minded. We are focused on that and that alone. And and it basically is just doing your duty as it is, as it comes to you in life, performing one's duty, and knowing that you are creating. So how you react is what it is. Sometimes it's best just not to react.
So then, would it be correct to say, karma yoga applied in just a simple way would be, I cut lawns for a living. I have a tendency of being miserable because I sweat so much and I don't think I make enough money. But would it be the application of karma yoga to stop being so self-centered about this, focus on the gratitude for the money that I'm earning so I can do the right things with it, and contributing to the beauty of the community? Would that be an example in a simple way of
Yes.
So you're doing the exact same thing in the outward world.
It's just your attitude.
Just
your attitude.
It's just a shift of attitude. So that,
and that would be a good first step.
Sure.
Minimum.
And thinking extended, you know, mowing those lawns means that varmints that might be living in them are gone. Allergens that might be produced for the environment are gone. Elderly folks are saved from heart attacks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many different ways to sustain still the attitude of I'm performing a service, and what it generates from that, what better can I do with the cash or just the physical health that comes with that kind of exertion.
Look at the world in which we live in. We see sacrifice everywhere. We you know, go to work every day. You know, do the things that we do. We think that, well, we don't have a choice. But we do. We just sacrifice ourselves. We don't think about it because it seems to be the law of the land. And those that don't do it are shunned. So,
I think another word for altruism is love and kindness.
Yes.
But Buddha mistook, you know, all this mortification of the body and self-denial and fasting until he was almost dying. And he sat down, you know, the banyan tree, and a little girl gave him water and finally came back to life. And he thought, hey, that's love and kindness. That's what sacrifice is. I'm not trying to kill myself.
Well, that's exactly it. It's, we no longer can go to a monastery or live in a cave because that age is past. We are living in a world that needs this knowledge, that needs to be exposed to these ideas in any way, shape, or form. I mean, because we are here, we think along certain lines. I guess our dharma is to let this become a living part of our life. Let these ideas really become alive. And that's through action.
And as we move through our daily lives, how can we miss the suffering of others? There's the struggle of young folks to try to figure out what's the right way to do something or what they're allowed to do versus what they want to do. We encounter folks that don't feel so well, others who are aging badly and need great help. And those that are caught up in the monkey mind reacting to the turmoil of the astral or the current events of the day. And if we move with that dharma, that duty of, you know, I've heard or read something that may give you another point of view on your suffering. That nurturing, that trying to help somebody else with knowledge that they can use for themselves, helping them to quell their mental anguish and maybe see a different point of view, that's more nourishing sometimes than physical food and offering physical comfort.
There's a very thin line between pleasure and pain. Mm-hmm. And that line is blurred at the extremes. It's blurred at the extremes so that it becomes like an addiction. Mm-hmm. And in one's mind, it becomes like a sacrifice unto that which they think is their God or whatever. But it's the most righteous thing that they can do, which is, you know, it's ignorance, you know, but it's the material application of a profound truth that our pain and suffering is really internal. The ideas that we hold, that we, the realities that we cling to, you know, and that's where all the pain and suffering is.
Yeah.
in the mind. In the mind.
And many among us cling to that. It's a multi-generational effect that's gone on for almost 2,000 years of wrongful teaching about the nature of the human being. So if for 2,000 years generations of families have raised their children on the concept of we are lowly sinners, bad things happen to us because we are far less than perfectible, we have to be saved by the vicarious atonement of another, there's a loss of power there. There's a loss of the truth of the divine essence of soul, and it's perpetuated. And if you, any small child raised in a household where suffering is rewarded, so if the only way the kid can get attention is to have a headache or to be sickly so that one or two of the parents will slow down and pay attention to them. That kind of habitual addiction to the external and the basis of thought that I'm helpless, I'm useless, I'm lowly, so I'm going to try to get reinforcement from the society in this other way, becomes quite a trap in life. And it's rooted in many ways in religious philosophy.
Well, we see in the general atmosphere of our world in which we live, the Mosaic law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Mm-hmm. It is the law of the land, and that is what is, and that is just karma of our time. That because materialism is so strong, our world is in conflict. Because man is internally in conflict. You can't be in a world with all this going on and not be morally in conflict. If you think about it, you know, it's like a sickening feeling that we are part of an apparatus that's killing people rampantly. And for any justification that will suit them. So, you know, I think our imagination has shown us that we do not have to kill each other. And these teachings show us that we are one, and that we are a brotherhood of humanity. We just have to act like one.
So however we find ourselves during the summer months, if we recall only this, that others are permeable to our thoughts, good and bad, and while awake, if we assume a spiritual basis for all thought, then we are doing tremendous kindness wherever we are, to uplift all. Our time is over. The debate is up.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. My voice has changed.
Something on the side.